There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the bill we got? I mean, the bill we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
Right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. And remember, you can check out podcasts of this hour and the other 40-some-odd hours a week of programming we're doing right here in Mobile, in Baldwin Counties. Check it out on our website. Go to fmtalk1065.com and click podcast. Of course, we'd love you to subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn Radio. Got them waiting for you right there. And remember, on Twitter, FM Talk Pods posts those podcasts every hour over on the Twitter feed. All right, I mentioned going into the news here that we would come back and talk about a subject that has come up, I think, almost every time there's been a CBD discussion on this show. Somebody calls in or somebody texts in with the question of what does this do for opioid people dealing with opioid addiction aftermath, or they're getting off opioids, and would CBD, and every time y'all have said something, I've had to say, I got no idea. I've heard things, but I've got no idea. I don't know what the science says. So imagine how interested I was when I saw a story that was up about research done at the University of Florida. And we'll go through that research with one of the people that put this research on, Jenny Wilkerson, Assistant Professor of Pharmacodynamics at the University of Florida. Am I close on that? Pharmacodynamics? How do I say that?
It is. You were right on the money. It's pharmacodynamics. Nicely done.
Okay, now that I know how to say it, tell me what it is, Jenny.
So pharmacodynamics is broadly defined as the study of the effects of drugs on the body.
Okay.
Simple as that.
I'm going to use that to win Trivial Pursuit sometime. Now I know that. But your headline here, CBD, the next weapon in the war against opioid addiction. What did y'all find out in your research? And talk to us about how you set this up, why you set this up, and what you found.
So I just wanted to clarify that actually we did not, here at University of Florida, we actually did not conduct this research that we're talking about. This was actually a research conducted by Dr. Yasmin Hurd at the Icahn School of Medicine in Mount Sinai in New York City. So
okay.
Just to make that clarification, that we actually didn't actually do this research. We just are in the same area of research as what was conducted.
Yes. Okay. Now, thank you for pointing that out.
Uh-huh.
And then kind of, what is the research to this point? Because, like I said in the opening, then I get people, every time we talk about CBD on the show, somebody's calling me, asking me this question, does it help with getting people off opioids?
Sure. So back in 2009, this group in New York reported that they had trained rats to press a lever to receive heroin. And so CBD did not decrease the amount of heroin that the rats administered in this assay. And they didn't alter their drug-seeking behavior while the rats were taking heroin. However, when you took the rats off of the heroin and you gave them CBD, there was a decrease in their drug-seeking behavior when these animals were exposed to a heroin-associated cue. And
okay.
So they took this one step further. And so in humans, it was verified with CBD when they co-administered it with fentanyl, it was safe and healthy and tolerated in healthy non-opioid-dependent individuals. And then in 2015, the same group took a small double-blind study conducted in opioid-dependent individuals, they found that single administration of CBD in comparison to a placebo in humans decreased cue-induced craving of opioids and feeling of anxiety in people that had previously been dependent on opioids.
All right, so put that in some Sullivanese for me here. So kind of lay out a scenario. You have what? You have two people that were addicted to, or maybe still, or they're addicted to opioids, but they've quit the opioids. Then one person gets a placebo, the other person gets the CBD, and the person that gets the CBD, do they not go back to opioids, or what is your finding?
So what that is, what this means, is that that person that receives the CBD, if they're given the same exact scenario as the other person, as far as the same stress levels, the same cues that are associated with their use, they're going to actually go back to using opioids a lot less than the person that's given the same exact conditions with a placebo on board.
Now, you write in this story a lot about, and it's fascinating, about how the brain plays its the part here in addiction, and how it's a, you know, you talk, and maybe you can tell us some more about that, how the brain is under the control of the addiction or the rewiring. But in the case of, like, you have two people in the study, I know you would have more, but you'd have two people in the study, could I argue that, is there, I mean, we're different as people, right? So could just the person that had the CBD have a bigger, a better ability to fight addiction, or is that the same among everybody? What's your thought?
So that's a very good question. So in general, although there are some genes that we know that predispose some individuals towards drug use, especially prevalent in minority populations, we are not exactly completely sure on why exactly some people become addicted and dependent on drugs of abuse, while some people can remain resilient and not become addicted or dependent on drugs of abuse. So that's an ongoing area of much research and much interest in the field. We're not exactly sure whether or not if you pre-treat someone with CBD that is susceptible to addiction, whether or not that would alter their actual development of addiction and dependence on a drug of abuse.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's a thought. I mean, that's a thought that you could, you're not saying that's so, but you're saying you're wondering if somebody taking CBD and then they get two people, one takes CBD, one doesn't, they get on opioids, and then maybe the person that took the CBD beforehand doesn't get hooked on the opioids. Am I understanding that?
That's one of the questions in the field now that a lot of leading scientists are trying to figure out, actually, yes.
What if that would happen, would it be about this brain rewiring that you all discuss in this story? If that was so, not saying it is, but if it was so, what would your guess be that, what would be the mechanism that would do that, protect? It'd almost be like getting a vaccine.
Correct. And so actually, there are some vaccines that are in development for opioid dependence and opioid abuse. So that is definitely an area forefront of scientific research. And so we know there are immune mechanisms that are in play when it comes to the rewiring of the brain. And we know that CBD can alter some inflammatory responses. So that's one mechanism that might be happening that might lead to kind of a protective state. There are also areas where, for example, with seizure activity for pediatric intractable seizures, where we know CBD is actually beneficial. We know that CBD does exert some neuroprotective effects as well, as far as the brain's ability to rewire itself and under dynamic circumstances like that. So there's likely a whole host of different mechanisms on how CBD might be able to do those things.
It's unbelievable. Can you hang on for a second, run the news break and come back? Got a couple more questions here.
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you. All right, coming back, and we'll grab some of your questions as well. Talking with Assistant Professor of Pharmacodynamics at the University of Florida, Jenny Wilkerson, with us right here on Midday Mobile. Phone number, text line open for you, 343-0106. You'll ask me all those questions before. Now I've got somebody who has looked into the research on this, 343-0106, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Glad you're along and really enjoying this conversation and hopefully getting some questions answered. Jenny Wilkerson, Assistant Professor of Pharmacodynamics at the University of Florida, talking with us about an article entitled, and I put it up on the Twitter feed, CBD, the Next Weapon in the War Against Opioid Addiction. And this is as two things here. I mean, you've described a possible cure or something to treat a symptom. At the same time, we delved off into a discussion of a possible vaccine to keep addiction from happening in the first place.
Yes, like I mentioned during our break, I know several groups that are currently in the development process of vaccines for opioid and other sorts of addictions.
I mean, this is, for a lot of us, pretty mind-blowing. I mean, this is not something we've thought of, that you would have something on the front. You would maybe give it to your children, right? When they get all their other vaccines, give them this vaccine. And then what, I mean, I know it's theory right now, but how would it work? Can you give us like a Wikipedia page version to understand how it might work to keep people from getting addicted?
Sure. So basically with this, so the layman's information that I have about this vaccine development is that basically you wouldn't want to give it to probably a kid. You'd probably want to wait until a little bit later on in life, closer to when you might become exposed to an opioid, or potentially after your first exposure and you're kind of on the fence on that transition period between like a medical use of an opioid, like for like you had a surgery and you needed some opioids after the surgery and you want to make sure you don't become addicted. Basically you would get the vaccine, and your body would start producing antibodies against some of the sort of things that go on in the body due to dependence and addiction. It's kind of where the brain starts to become recircuited and rewired. And so this vaccine would basically kick into play to where those chains of events would not happen to the same degree as they would in a non-vaccinated individual.
You talk about the rewiring under addiction, rewiring of the brain. Is that something that can you see that anywhere, or is it just through scientific study? I mean, is there, can you run an MRI and see that this is a rewired brain?
I don't believe we're quite there yet. What we can do is, in especially animals, we can measure levels of neurotransmitters that are related to addiction and kind of behavior, as far as neurotransmitters that modulate behavior, so things like dopamine we can measure. And so we know that these drugs of abuse alter dopamine, this neurotransmitter that's really important for regulating normal behavior and how we respond to our daily stimulus around us. And so we've found in pretty much every single drug of abuse, dopamine is dysregulated, so that you need that drug on board to have a normal level of functioning. And so that's really where we believe the science is that comes into play as far as how drugs of abuse rewire and kind of recircuit the brain. Is basically it goes and it takes what should be a normal, everyday, pleasurable experience, like having lunch with your friends and having good social atmosphere, and then all of a sudden it drops it down to where all of a sudden your lunch with your friends is no longer the top, a highlight of your day. It's really getting your drug of abuse that becomes the highlight of your day.
So
what people look forward to.
So it's taking, so you would keep, I guess, with this, you keep the dopamine level up so you could enjoy that lunch, so that lunch would give you the dopamine level, not the drug.
Correct, yeah, in layman's terms.
Excellent. And that's how I need them. Going forward, I mean, we talk about this study showing in this double blind study with these rats that the rats that are to have the heroin taken away, the ones that receive the CBD versus the placebo, stayed away from the heroin better. When does this, you know, you're talking about use in humans, when does this become part of a, would this go to physicians to prescribe? I mean, it doesn't have to be prescribed as CBD, or do people, would people just go buy it at the store? What is, how do you picture that working?
So what they used in this study is already FDA approved. It's Epidiolex, which is currently the only form of CBD that is regulated by the FDA. It's the only thing that it's, is actually approved for medical use in the United States. So Epidiolex was approved for prescribing indications of pediatric intractable epilepsy. And so it is available for medical use. So once a drug is approved for medical use, it becomes a lot easier for physicians to prescribe it off the label. So this is what the terminology is. So, and then as far as regulatory steps, the company, in this case, GW Pharmaceuticals, is going to have a lot easier case with a couple more expanded trials to get this approved for the use of this type of actual indication of opioid dependence.
You mentioned the use of CBD in the form of treating the epilepsy in children. That's the, I mean, it's the same. I watched that research done right here in Alabama. Is that the same research?
Yes.
Okay. Because I know that that's been, okay, so that, so this, so it will be, it has the name Epidiolex, and it would be up to a physician then, I mean, somebody would come in and say, I have a opioid addiction, and then they would prescribe this, or they'd say, hey, I'm off it, but I'm scared I'm going to get back on it. How do you see it being prescribed?
So according to the science, so far it looks like, especially with the rat study, it looks like if you're taking a direct translation from the preclinical research, it doesn't seem like CBD is going to be incredibly helpful for people who are currently taking opioids that are dependent on opioids. And so it really seems to be working the best scientifically when people are off the opioids and they're trying to stay clean. They're trying to abstain from going back on opioids due to opioid dependence, all the side effects, the anxiety, depression that can come along with going into withdrawal long-term with opioids.
All right, so this way, because I'm looking at a bunch of texts, but this one from Laura stood out to me. What about prenatal addicted babies? I guess in that case, it wouldn't be successful, right?
I'm not sure. So doing research on prenatal infants or in infants that are exposed to opioids prenatally is very difficult to obtain approval for.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we know biologically their systems are not fully developed, so we're not quite sure how CBD in a pediatric patient, especially one that's been prenatally exposed to opioids, how that would actually work.
And this could be, I mean, looking at this, and I'm excited about this because this issue, and I don't think just obviously the state of Alabama has a big issue, but I know where you are in Florida, and gosh, you know what, the other 48 states have it as well.
Mm-hmm.
With these, this addiction rate is so very, very high that, and you have people that are absolutely well-meaning. I mean, Lord knows, we don't have to go too far to hear the stories of somebody who, they didn't want to go get on drugs, they had it prescribed for medical reasons or this or that, and could never get clear from it. Something like this might be what keeps them clean.
Correct.
This is pretty exciting research y'all are doing mm-hmm. at the University of Florida. And I guess the just keep watching and look for Epidiolex. Somebody asking what it's called. Epidiolex, right?
Epidiolex, yes.
And we've linked the story through on Twitter where y'all can see the name there and find out more about this. Well, thank you for your time. Thanks for the insight into this, Jenny. We sure appreciate it. And keep up the good research down there at the University of Florida.
All right. Thank you so much.
All right. Jenny Wilkerson, Assistant Professor of Pharmacodynamics at the University of Florida. And that link is on the Twitter feed. This is fascinating stuff. Fascinating stuff. And once again, that's why this story caught my attention, too. It's not this idea that it's, you know, something that fixes everything. You heard the professor say that this is not you know, somebody who is currently on it. It's people who are trying to get off of it. And in this double-blind study with placebo and the CBD, the people that use this CBD were better able to get off this. Pretty incredible stuff. All right, grab calls when we get back. Phone number 343-0106, 343-0106. Also, we'll take you to Montgomery here after the break. I know, you said, why? Because it's the last week of the legislative session, and they are getting ready. Every rumor I hear is they will wrap this thing by Friday. Now, they still have a couple big questions out there. Now, Lotto is long since down the road. That didn't happen. The medical marijuana bill they talked about is going to be held over in a research and study phase until next year. Maybe it's a 2021 issue they're looking at. But they still have not finalized children's health insurance program. They've not finalized all the teacher raises inside the ETF. They haven't even finalized some of the nuance within the general fund budget. So we'll run through that list of items that are still facing the members of the legislature as they got back in. I think they're gaveling in. I think the House gaveled in already, and the Senate gavels in about 3 o'clock this afternoon. So we'll talk about that with you when we get back. All right. 343-0106. 343-0106. Also, a reminder, go through and look at the GoFundMe page that's up for the children of Rod and Paula Bramlett, who were tragically killed over the weekend. I mean, like that. A friend of mine and his wife gone, voice of the Auburn Tigers, and two children left behind. And that GoFundMe page is up as they're trying to raise $250,000 for those children who all of a sudden, in a blink of an eye, were orphans.
With Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, Dalton, watch for an email. Watch for an email from Professor Wilkerson. She said she was going to send us. There during the news break, she mentioned, it's like all the things that have been asked on the show, it sounds like that's the research they're doing at the University of Florida. She mentioned they some research done on kratom, right, that we've had the calls about in the past. People said it helped them. I know that vets, they've called me, said that it helped them not take the fistful of pills that they had been taking before, that the kratom did them great wonders. I've heard it from, once again, it's not a science advice show. This is just, I'm a guy who's interested in stuff. And that's another one. So CBD and kratom, they're going to do the research into kratom too. So we'll see if these things live up to it. And what about, I mean, was anybody else, not, you know, it's cliche to say mind blown, I think it's what the kids say, but how about highly interested with the amount of work being done for an addiction vaccine? Have you ever thought of that? We're always on the right, we're thinking about the other side of this, right? People are addicted. How do you quit smoking, right? How do you get off booze, or how do you get off these pills, or how do you get, what, it's always dealing with, you know. And then you go back and think what mom said, right? An ounce of prevention worth more than a pound of cure. Maybe there's truth in that. Maybe there's truth in having before, like, okay, because I told you my big fear is that they crack down so much on these pain medicines that one day when I do have to go to the hospital and get an operation, that they won't be available to me, right? So one of my many reasons to stay, you know, away from drugs in life is like the pharmaceutical stuff, that I want it when I need it to, like, really, really work. Like, if I have to go into the hospital and get a surgery, I want it to work. I want to be a wimp and say, it's fine, give it to me. There we go. Now I don't feel anything. But the worry is, of course, getting hooked on these. So what about a situation where somebody has the knee replacement surgery or whatever you're getting ready to go into, and knowing that they're going to prescribe these opioids, and you could take, even later in life, the way she's describing this, you could take a vaccine so you know you wouldn't get addicted to these things down the road. I mean, that's not the current science yet, but they're working towards that. Fascinating to me. Fascinating. All right, let's run through what's happening or not happening in Montgomery this last week of session. And it's not officially the last week of session, but that's kind of the word from Goat Hill. All right, so what do they have left? Budgets. All right. Education Trust Fund and General Fund are doing all right. In the ETF, they would provide raises for to education and state employees. We heard the governor talk about that, along with general funding boost to agencies and programs. Legislators are still trying to figure out how to provide further funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program. That's CHIP. Not CHIPS, not the California Highway Patrol motorcycle cops. This is Children's Health Insurance Program that was mandated by Congress last year. So here are the dollar amounts. Legislature must find $35 million to fund the program. You picture them like on a scavenger hunt or something trying to find $35 million to fund that program. Federally mandated, provides health insurance coverage for children in households making up to 312% of the federal poverty level. Program plays a major role in keeping Alabama's rate of uninsured children low. Okay, so right now the legislators are splitting the $35 million between both budgets, so the general fund of the ETF, but the legislative leaders expect to discuss that further in conference committees this week. House Speaker Mac McCutcheon also said a bonus for education retirees may come up during negotiations. Said it boils down to some line item issues. Dollars from the Children Health Insurance Program and who's going to pay for them. Also, I think this is a story we're talking about now, and nobody seems very engaged in it, maybe outside of Goat Hill. But if this happens, the hue and cry, you'll hear it from a lot of folks, and then it'll be a big deal. Once it happens, if it does happen, once it happens, then it'll be the big subject everybody wants to talk about. That it, like you care, right? Like you've shown you care. The State Board of Education, you know who your rep is? Anybody? With that exception of three or four people on the text line that live in anybody other than those four, Dalton, you know who I'm talking about. Can you tell me who the rep for us on the State Board of Education is? Familiar last name, I'll say that. So this idea, this amendment that has been brought up by Senate President Pro Tem Del Marsh would replace the current elected State Board of Education with a body appointed by the governor, not somebody, but a group, which would then appoint a secretary of primary and secondary education, replacing the current state superintendent. So basically the system we have now would be gone. If approved, the measure would go to we the voters next March. President Pro Tem Del Marsh said last week it was a priority for his chamber. I mean, I think I can argue this either way. I wouldn't go on. It says current members of the SBOE argue the elected structure requires them to be more responsive to constituents in a way an appointed board might not be. Marsh and others, other supporters argue that an appointed board could help improve education outcomes, but education experts say appointed school boards appear to have less impact on scores than elected superintendents or elected groups that have an appointed superintendent. Marsh said the latter was originally part of his bill, but taken out to secure some support of some education groups. Now, is it fair enough to ask when you go to vote for State Board of Education? I know there's some people that are super engaged. And by the way, Dalton, now other than those four people, not a person on the text line, not a person knows who their representation is on State Board of Education. See what I mean? So should we be voting for it? If the closest thing to your voting knowledge when you vote for State Board of Education is just like, well, I kind of recognize that name, maybe. If that's as in-depth as you're going in this, should it be an elected position or should it be one that maybe is appointed? I don't know that I'm convinced either way yet, but I think it's, yes, Keith, nice. Keith got it, good. Keith, let me add you to the list, about 12 of us on that life raft that knew that answer. But Keith, you're definitely on it, so Keith got it first. And you're asking, yeah, it's Jackie Ziegler. But I'm not saying this in a mean way. It's just not subject matter du jour, right, for most people who's the rep on the State Board of Education. So is that the best way to put people on there, or is it better to have a system where you have those representatives in a representative republic that would nominate somebody? I don't know. Like I said, I'm not solid on either side of this, but I think it's a worthwhile discussion and one that would behoove us to pay attention to as much lip service as folks go, well, you know, the children and we got to do stuff for the children. Well, then maybe we ought to know who's on the State Board of Education. All right, let's take some calls here. 343-0106, 343-0106. It's Dr. Lou Campagnosi up first. Hey, Dr. Lou.
Hey, Sean, how are you doing?
I'm good. Scratching my head here, though, just trying to ask some questions. If we change the way this was done, are we missing out here? Are we doing a good job of putting the right people in those positions?
Well, I think that what's happened is that you've got a false narrative that's been created by particularly Marsh. His main objective earlier was to win favor with the conservatives by raising the issue about Common Core through SB 119, which was going to repeal it. Then he changed his mind about getting, running for Sessions' seat. And what you end up getting now is his reform approach, which includes this moving in a direction of an appointed board. Our objections to this whole narrative, though, is that the crisis in Alabama education has less to do with the State Board of Education, given what we see as its recent history. So 2003 to 2009, you had the Alabama Reading Initiative rated in the top three in the country. Scores went up across the board. Socioeconomic race didn't matter. Everyone improved. Then, and this is the key for where we are with this, Sean, in 2010, it's Governor Riley who put on, Common Core. And again, we can go back and forth on the degree to which Common Core is a problem, this, that, and the other. But for us, for the last 8 years, we've been fighting Common Core, and our argument has been, as long as you have two of the key educators in this country, James Milgram in math and Sandra Sotchke in English, refusing to validate the Common Core standards, then that should have been a red flag for what Riley and them were doing. And it wasn't. They went ahead and did it. They put Dr. Bice in charge of implementing it in 2010. And the next thing you know, within a short period of time, the scores start coming down. Now look, I am not score happy, but there has to be some sort of accountability. But if you're going to argue that the State Board of Education is the cause of this crisis because of dysfunctionality, then you have to look at what happened before Common Core. And that takes me to the point where I'm suggesting there is something really wrong with the narrative that these folks are trying to suggest, that it's the Board of Education's problem and that some sort of an appointed board would work better. And I think that to me is the critical issue. That's why we are doing whatever we can do to keep this SB 397, I think it is, from passing. I don't know if we're going to be successful with that or not, because they seem to be determined to be able to centralize education across the board, and in my view, it just doesn't work that way.
Here's the problem is, as a state, I'm not pointing fingers elsewhere, I'm pointing fingers at myself too, that Alabamians are more engaged with who the third string quarterback is at their favorite team than their representation on the State Board of Education. I mean, I'm not trying to pick on, but I think it's true.
Well, yeah, I think that's an issue that in fact, I talked to some representative from Washington County the other day, and he said the same thing. They don't know anything. I said, well, don't you have a leadership responsibility to educate the people, your constituents? I mean, look, here's another issue that the supposedly conservative API basically is making the argument that this is a governance issue, that the governor is, really looks responsible for education, but doesn't have the power to actually be held accountable. And all I can think of, when's the last time anybody really looked at Governor Riley having any problems doing what he wanted to do with education? And then even Ivy, back in March, made the superintendent Mackey stop the changes on the math program that they had been revising for a whole year. So to argue that there's lack of the ability on the part of the governor to influence what's going on, and it just doesn't make sense to me at all.
Well, we're going to have to, I think a lot of people listening right now are have to do their due diligence and educate ourselves on this, because it has not been, it should be, as much as we say, hey, we're worried about the kids, we're worried about the children, we're worried about education, we need to make sure we're engaged in all this. I mean, the business of education, the administration of education, that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I mean, here's the dilemma across the board in every everything, whether it's foreign policy issues, the bridge toll, things like that. People are working two jobs in some cases. I mean, it's, you know, 9 to 5, you get home, and then, or it's, you know, 6 in the morning to 6 at night, mm-hmm. and then we're expecting everyone to be fully engaged as we are. Now, look, I'm a retiree. I teach part-time at Spring Hill. So, I mean, I've got time to do these things, but I don't know what the solution is. I do say one part of the solution, though, is that the local media, the press register, you know, they do very little to alert people to what's going on in, you know, the political world. And I think that, that is an aspect of this that we've complained about for a long time. But, you know, how you solve this, I guess you better just have a committee to kind of figure it out, or a commission. I don't know.
You know how to solve it. It's FM Talk 106.5, 40 hours a week
of
shows.
There you go. That's it. And we do some stuff with you guys.
Yep.
In fact, can I just transfer to another quick thing?
Yeah, I do want to ask you about the bridge, but you got to hold on. I got to run the news break, or they're going to get mad at me. Can you hold on a second? We'll come right back, because I wanted to ask that same question, but the news waits on no one. Well, it does sometimes, but I'm not. They got to go now, and then we'll be right back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, Dalton, do you see those pictures on the text line? See what I was talking about? That's what I was wondering, if that has been factored in on soybean prices. Not to nerd out too much, maybe that's why I need. I'm doing 26 hours of radio now. I'll do a couple more in a podcast form, like an additional podcast. Doesn't even go on air. We can have Ag Talk. But that was just kind of the angle that I was wondering about here, because these pictures coming in show that looks like, my best guess, look at the pictures, that's Highway 49 north of Yazoo City, Mississippi, in the Delta. And it's just that this was pictures taken like in the last few days, still all flooded. So when they look at soybean demand and the issues with the tariffs on that, I wonder if they have taken into play, I know the people at the Mercantile Exchange have taken into play, how many acres will be planted very late for soybeans or not even make it into soybeans this year. I don't, it's a, like I said, that's a side nerd tangent. We can keep that conversation going on Twitter if you want to, or on the text line. All right, he held on for us. I hope, Dr. Liu, are you still there?
I'm still here, Sean.
Okay. Yes. What's the update on, we're now past the comment period on the bridge tolling.
Right. Kevin Sprazier and I just met today, and he's been in contact with other folks, and we're going to go into a phase two approach, which will keep the issue on the burner. In fact, I've got to call your folks, Bill Rawls, to start looking at another ad campaign. We're going to do some other local media campaigning, and I think that the direction we're going in is that we've got to establish before July, when the ALDOT makes its decision, you know, why it is that we cannot get financing. We think that there are issues pertaining to why Senator Shelby seems to be, you know, standing above the fray here instead of rolling up his sleeves and fighting for the people of Alabama. So I think that the direction we're going to try to go to is to come up with an alternative means of funding, and that there are some things that Kevin has worked out. In fact, he would like to get on with you, and I'll talk to you about that later.
Okay, yeah, we'll do that.
We want to try to develop this in a more full, a better perspective that gives you an alternative to the funding that they're looking at, and raises questions about why they are not using public bonding instead of what they're trying to do.
Yeah, Dr. Liu, this is something I talked about at length with Jeff Poore over the weekend, actually, hanging out. And number one, the question of Senator Shelby, head of appropriations, if there was ever, you know, a chance to bring the whole pork wagon home, I mean, he's in that
exactly.
he's in that position. And the other one, if you heard an interview I had last week with Congressman Bradley Byrne, he said in that interview that he said that the state wasn't interested in federal money anymore. Now, I've been told there's nuance to that, that was maybe, you know, not fully thought out by the folks at ALDOT. But he said, Congressman Byrne said that, I guess John Cooper said, they weren't interested in federal money anymore, that they were only on the tolling.
Well, I think that to a certain degree, that leads to the question, what brought about a comment like that Cooper is not interested? I mean, we are all interested in finding, you know, the funding that is not only deserved, but absolutely necessary because of the nature of, you know, this problem. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. And that leads us back to, without necessarily becoming too conspiratorial, you know, the question of, well, what is really driving this whole funding issue? And I think that's where we're going next, and we'll have more, you know, more to say about that in the next couple of weeks.
Good stuff. Dr. Liu, I appreciate your update here, and talk to us again soon. We'll get more on that. And it's, yeah, there's, and when Jeff joins me tomorrow, and Dalton and I, when he comes on at 8, we'll talk more about this with Jeff. You can check out Jeff's work over on Twitter. It's a fair question, right? I'm saying, you know, people get all gunched up about that, but is it not a fair question? I said it from the time he got the nomination to be head of the appropriations. I mean, Senator Shelby was already one of the biggest dogs in Washington. And when he moved, and I mean dogs, like not offensive dogs, like dogs, like big dog. Big dog in Washington. Listen, it doesn't matter. He doesn't talk to me anymore anyway. I'm not trying to. But then to be head of appropriations, you figure, this is going to be great. This is going to be fantastic. And then, like Dr. Liu and many others have asked, okay, then how can you not move some? What are we at, 7%? That is if the InfraGrant money comes into the state. It's $170 million-something dollars. And now, believe me, give me $170 million, I'm good. I'm good. You won't hear from me. You won't hear from my children or grandchildren or maybe great-grandchildren. But for a bridge project of this size, that is not a bunch of money when you're talking about over $2 billion, $2.2, $2.3 billion project. So you got ahead of it. You are in the pork barrel position of all pork barrel positions, Senator Shelby. And there's the whole story. I put it up a couple times last week. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Politico story last week that it was Senator Shelby holding out for harbor dredging money that was holding up the disaster relief bill. I mean, they called him out by name in that Politico story. Dalton, update when we get the next email from Shelby's folks updating on what he's doing. We hadn't gotten. In 2 years, yeah, I hadn't gotten that either. All right, but I'm looking for it. 158. I'm out of here. Paul Feinbaum on the way next. See y'all in the morning for another edition of Mobile Mornings. Have a great one.